shop with an old green door. He's dying all day, your linen away. He really makes me sore. He's lost his heart to a Chinese girl, and his laundry's all gone wrong. All day he'll flirt, scorch your shirt. That's why I'm singing this song. Oh, Mr. Wu, what shall I do? I'm feeling kind of Limehouse Chinese laundry blues. This funny feeling keeps round me stealing. Oh, won't you throw your sweetheart overdue? My vest's so short that it won't fit my little brother, and my new Sunday shirt has got a perforated rudder. Mr. Wu, what shall I do? I'm feeling kind of Limehouse Chinese laundry blues. Now Mr. Wu, he's got a naughty eye that flickers. You ought to see it wobble when he's ironing ladies' blouses. Mr. Wu, what shall I do? I'm feeling kind of Limehouse Chinese laundry blues. Now Mr. Wu, he's got a laundry kind of tricky. He starts my shirts and collars, but he never touch me waistcoat. Mr. Wu, what shall I do? I'm feeling kind of Limehouse Chinese laundry blues.
Chinese Laundry Blues, the voice of George Formby Jr., born 1904, died in 1961 at the age of 56. British comedy actor, singer, songwriter and comedian, and a man who played the ukulele. Probably the world's expert on George Formby is Chris Webster. He's an Englishman living in Alicante in Spain, and he's an audio restoration specialist. I called Chris in Spain to talk to him about George Formby, a man he knows a lot about.
Quite a lot. Certainly a lot about his career. And over the years, lots of people have come forward, friends, so you get to know more about the man as well. But also, just at the very end of his life, which he didn't know was the end of his life, he did this wonderful TV show, and he just sat down on his own in the chair, and he told his life story. And more came across about the man in that half hour than you can read in any book. It's absolutely wonderful. We'll hear a little bit of that later.
Yes.
But it all started with his father, because his father had been a music hall entertainer, a very big and very successful one. Now, I could go on at length about his dad, but we're not here to speak about him. The long and short of it is that his dad also died young. He was only 45 when he died in 1921. Mm-hmm. And not long after his dad had died, George Formby, the son, was in London with his mother, and they went to a music hall, and they saw somebody impersonating the father. And the mother thought, this isn't right. If anyone's going to impersonate my husband, it's going to be my son. So they put young George on the stage. He'd never seen his dad. His dad had always said, one fool in the family's quite enough, and wouldn't let him see him on stage. So he didn't know his dad's act. But they had the recordings to listen to. He'd made 160 recordings, incredibly. Mm-hmm. Most of which I'll be issuing in a few box sets in probably about 2 years' time. Mm-hmm. On CD. Recordings that are still funny today. They're songs, but they've got patter in the middle that still make me chuckle, you know, so they're still value for money today. So so George learned some of the songs and the patter with the help of his mother, and went on stage, and he wasn't awfully good at it, but he got by, and he met a young lady called Beryl. But we're jumping ahead of ourselves a little bit there.
Yeah.
What I'd like to do now is I've put a track together for you, one of his dad's recordings of a song called John Willie Come On, because that was the character that his father had on stage, of this little humble Lancashire man. And in 1926, George Formby Jr. went into the studio, and he cut six sides, five of which were his father's songs, and the sixth one was in the same style. And so here we can listen to these, and you can hear there's such a similarity between the two voices. And this is sort of where I come in on the story, because many, many years ago I was at a friend's house. I'd gone there to listen to vintage Gilbert and Sullivan records, and a record had just come out, an LP that he was quite pleased with. And this is a friend of mine, Jim Craig, who we've collaborated so many times now. He's a great help to me because he's so knowledgeable on restoration techniques. So Jim said to me, have a listen to this. Tell me who you think this is. And he played this recording, and I said, well, it's obvious it's George Formby. He said, well, you're right, but you're wrong. I said, how can I be right and wrong? He said, well, it is George Formby, but it's George Formby Sr., it's his dad. I said, that's remarkable, it sounds so like him. So if we have a listen to this, you'll see what I mean. It's dad singing the first verse and the son singing the second verse.
Here it is.
I'm a man that's fond of seeing life, and my wife, by the way, she said to me, John Willis, you shall have a holiday. She took me up to London, the sights to let me see. And when we arrived at St. Pancake, my wife, she said to me, John Willis, come on. Mind you, don't get the nor. A lady came to me and said, have we not met before? My wife said, miss, how dare you, that my husband's so begone. You know it's mine, I found it first. John Willie, come on. Get ready, lads. We went in Madame Tussauds waxwork show, and it was grand. And there we saw all waxwork kings and queens all shaking hands. There was Mary Queen of Scots and Queen Elizabeth, you see. They fairly took me fancy when the wife, she said to me, John Willis, come on, it's closing time, you see. The lights went out and all was dark and quiet as can be. On turning round, to my surprise, I found my wife had gone. And I'm sure I heard Queen Elizabeth say, John Willie, come on.
Father and son, Formby, father and son.
Yep, that's remarkable, isn't it?
It is remarkable, yeah.
And I don't think there was a great deal of effort went into that. I don't think it was a complete impression. I think the sound was just there between the two of them.
There's extraordinary similarity, and yet they never sang together.
No, didn't see him on stage. Well, neither of them saw either on stage, because his father didn't have any clue that anybody would follow him into the business,
yeah.
And he didn't want them to either.
No, in fact,
he'd been ill for a long time, and he knew that his time was short. He just worked and worked and worked to put money in the bank to look after the family.
Right. So what about
What
about the early career then? How did it take off?
Well, there were two things that happened early on. As I said, he wasn't very good doing his dad's act, but he met a young lady called Beryl Ingham, who at the time was in a club dancing duo called the Two Violets, with her sister May, and he fell in love with Beryl and married her, and she was a wonderful businesswoman, and she also had a great feeling of what was right and wrong on stage and what was right and wrong for George, and she steered him away from this very corny material of his dad's, which was fine for his dad but not for Junior, you know. And then the second thing that happened around about the same time is he discovered this instrument called the ukulele. And that combination of Beryl's acumen for business and theatre and putting the uke in, once that went in the act, he didn't look back. Of course, they had a few quid as well, so they were able to put their own shows on. They could put his name at the top of the bill. as the George Formby Review. And Beryl was still very much part of the act. She'd split up with the club dancing act, but she was very much part of the act with her husband.
So she took him over.
Very, very successful reviews of these shows.
Yeah, yeah. And she took him over then as manager.
She certainly did, right up to the very, very end. They only died 3 months apart. It's incredible. But yeah. Yes, she looked after him right to the end.
I was reading something about him. It sounds as though it wasn't the happiest of marriages.
I think it was. Yeah, I don't believe that. There's a lot of things. People like to hear the bad things, don't they?
I see.
I don't believe that at all. I mean, no partnership is perfect, is it? But no, I think they were a great team, both personally in the private life and professionally.
Oh, that's interesting. Great. Yeah. And so
I've got a recording from George's first film in which he didn't sing Chinese Laundry Blues, but Beryl tap danced to it. And I thought it might be nice to hear this because she was actually a champion clog dancer, but for the film she swapped the clogs for taps. but you can just hear how good she was, even though it's only in the soundtrack. So I thought we might have a listen to this.
Okay, here it is. So that's Beryl dancing, tap dancing.
Yeah, along with
that's amazing. That's not that wouldn't be too well known, would it? That record?
No, that's from a film soundtrack. That's from his very first film called Boots Boots. At the end of it, they're both working in a hotel. He's the lad that cleans the boots, and she's a maid. But at the end, as these films go, they become the star cabaret. So George comes out with a ukulele and Beryl does a tap dance.
I see.
Oh, the magic of pictures.
Yeah. So tell me what...
It's interesting because they reckon that George learned his rhythms for the ukulele from Beryl's tap dancing because he'd strum a uke and she would practice her taps to it and he would then pick that rhythm up on the uke and he developed this lovely style of his own which we'll hear in the next record in a moment.
I see. So do you mean he didn't read... He could read music or he couldn't read music?
No, he was musical, and he was certainly a musician, but he couldn't read music, no. But then again, neither could Pavarotti, and it didn't do him any harm, did it?
Yes. Yeah, okay, so what's the next one, Chris?
Well, just before we had a recording that that George Jr. made in 1926 of one of his dad's records. Now, they didn't take off very well at all. Then in 1929, he'd introduced the ukulele, and he I don't know how it happened, but he had a one-off contract to do two sides for the small Winner label. So he made a record with the ukulele there. Again, didn't really take off. And then 1932, he was at a party with Jack Hilton. And they're just a party piece. They were playing songs around. And, and Jack said, oh, I'd like to record that song with you. And that was the Chinese Laundry Blues, which he opened with. And that took off immediately. In fact, that was put on as the B-side, but it was the B-side that became the hit. That took off immediately.
Yeah.
And he went on to record with Gats until his final year. So that's nearly a 30-year span of recording.
That's
more if you go back to 1926, of course, about 35 years of recording.
Amazing output, isn't it?
Yeah. But you see, he was still working on the stage at the time, still doing his reviews and getting into pantomimes.
Yeah.
And he managed to get into films, only on a small level, because it was a small company called Mancunian Films. And he made this film, Boots Boots, which I've just mentioned, which is really just a string of sketches. There's no plot to it, really. And nobody thought it was going to do much good. And it did. It was a huge hit. They were wrapped around the cinemas to try and get in to see it. And they made two films for Mancunian. And then the people from Ealing, or ATP as it was at the time, Associated Talking Pictures, they were looking for a new star, really, to match the success of Gracie Fields.
Mm.
And, of course, George's on film is more or less a male Gracie, isn't he? The typical happy-go-lucky Lancastrian who wins in the end, you know.
Yeah.
So they gave him a film, No Limit, which was the famous T.T. Racer's film.
Mm-hmm.
And that really took off for him. And in the end, he made 20 films altogether, all of which were very successful.
Oh,
cool. So what I'd like to play now is possibly my favourite recording, I think. With one exception, that would be a Desert Island recording. But this one, I think, is great. This encapsulates everything. It's the song that he finishes on in his second film, which is still a Mancunian film. And if you look at this on YouTube, it's called With My Little Ukulele in My Hand, from the film Off the Dole. If you watch it, it's more or less like watching him live, because it's before he'd gone to Ealing. It was a small company. It was done live. It wasn't dubbed to. You know, he wasn't putting the sound on before and then miming to it. So you're looking at him. He looks $1 million. He's wearing white tie tail suit, and it's just a one-shot camera straight on him, totally live, and it's wonderful to watch. And this is one of his first records. So we're not in the film version now, but what we're going to hear is one of his first records, which incidentally was banned. A few review copies got out, and they said, "Oh, this is a bit naughty. No, we're not going to have this." And so they withdrew it. And he had to re-record it and dumb down the words of one of the verses. But this one is the original, because a copy was found for an LP reissue. So this is the original. And it's got a great tune, very, very funny, and it's got an absolutely blistering ukulele solo.
So we'll take the risk and have a listen.
Everybody's got a crazy notion of their own. Some like to mix up with the crowd, some like to be alone. It's no one else's business, as far as I can see. But every time that I go out, the people stare at me with my little ukulele in my hand. Of course the people do not understand. Some say, why don't you be a scout, why don't you read a book? But I get lots more pleasure when I'm playing with me, you. Of course I take no notice, you can tell. For mother's sound advice will always stand. She said, my boy, do what I say, and you'll never go astray if you keep your ukulele in your hand. Yes, son, keep your ukulele in your hand. While walking down the from last night, as peaceful as can be, when some young girl said, what about a stroll down by the sea? She said her name was Jane and that she'd just come for the day. She looked so young and harmless that I couldn't turn away. So with my little ukulele in my hand, I took a stroll with Jane along the sand. We walked along for miles without a single care or frown. But when we reached the sand hill, she said, come on, let's sit down. I felt so shy and bashful sitting there, 'cause the things she said I didn't understand. She said, your love just turns me dizzy, come along, big boy, get busy. But I kept my ukulele in my hand. Yes, sir, I kept my ukulele in my hand. Made up my mind that I'd get wed some 18 months ago. I also bought a book about the things you want to know. But just about a week ago I got an awful fright. I had to get dressed quickly in the middle of the night, and with my little ukulele in my hand, I ran along the road for Dr. Brand. It didn't take him long to get his little bag of tools. I held his hat and coat and let him have my book of rules. Out of the bedroom door he looked and smiled. Said, come inside and see your wife and child. My heart, it jumped with joy. I could see it was a boy, for he had a ukulele in his hand. Oh, baby, he had a ukulele in his hand. For he had a ukulele
my little ukulele in my hand, George Formby, and we're talking to Chris Webster in Spain. Chris Webster, audio restoration specialist, and talking direct from Spain to Radio Ekaterina and Radio Woodville. And thank you again, Chris, for talking to us. George Formby, what an extraordinary man is coming out of your story. After this, after that song, what happened?
Well, he carried on working in the theatre. He carried on making films, and he also did a lot of work on the radio. And until just a few years ago, we hardly had any example of George on the radio. And then a remarkable thing happened. I can't say that I made the discovery, because it happened on the internet. They just appeared on eBay. But somebody found 49, 78 discs of radio recordings from 1938 of a show that he did for Radio Luxembourg, which was incredible.
Well,
absolutely incredible.
Yes.
The bizarre thing for me is that they were only 10 minutes up the road from where I'd lived in Croydon for, I think, 8 years. They're so near, yet so far.
Been there all
what
that
has
time.
Happened, a couple, when they were quite young in 1979, had moved into a house in Mitcham, and the house had been a nursing home. It had been split into flats, and they got the top apartment. And they also got the loft with it. And the husband went into the loft and found these records. Thought, these are very interesting. Cut forward a few years, and they're moving house, and he's starting to take the records with him, because it's always been in the back of his mind, oh, I must let the British Museum have these, or, you know, the sound archive or whatever.
Mm.
It didn't happen. Cut forward a few more years, and the husband's passed away, and the wife has had them, by this time, gathering mould in the garden shed. And she's downsizing, so they go on eBay, and I get them.
And
then I make a special trip over to England from Spain to collect them. And I've got a little dubbing studio at my parents' house, because obviously I can't get the 78s from Spain to from England to Spain, or not very easily when there's nearly 50 of them. So I dub them all in the studio that I've got over in the UK. Then they're all on the computer ready for me to fiddle around with. When I was back in Spain, which I did. Now, if this is quite amusing, I hope you keep this in. It was a sponsored program, as they are, you know, for Radio Luxembourg, and as most shows were in America at the time. And it tickles me, this, because Bing Crosby used to work for, his sponsors were the cigarette company.
Yeah.
Al Jolson's sponsors were Kraft Cheese. Gracie Fields on Luxembourg, she worked for Fairy Soap.
Yeah.
But George Formby's sponsor was Phenamint, a laxative.
Oh.
What I'd like to play now, just at the start of one of the shows, the announcer more or less gets everything in it. I think it's about 30 seconds. So a lovely little start, this. And then once we've heard that, I'll just go very quickly into the restoration technique that I put over it.
Okay, here it is.
The proprietors of Phenomen present George Formby.
Hello, everybody. Keeping fit?
That's right.
And his ukulele. Accompanied by John Furman and the Phenomen Orchestra. And now, on with the show.
Okay, so that was the intro. And what followed that?
There were lots of songs and sketches. I worked it out. He did this show for 2 years in 6 month periods, and there would have been over 200 sides, because each show was four sides. It was about 15 or 20 minutes, so they had 478 sides that they would have two players, and they would start one and then swap to the next one, and in the meantime, they're preparing the first one with side three and so on.
Right.
So there would have been over 200 sides, and we've got 49 of them. That makes you wonder where the rest of them are. Why aren't they all together?
Yeah, what a discovery.
What we've got. But of course, they didn't sound anything like what we've just heard then, because 78s are just on very noisy shellac. They're not on vinyl. Although, oddly, that some of these do turn up, and they are on early vinyl. Some of the Gracie Fields sides from the exact same radio series, station, rather. Are on vinyl records, but George's aren't. But I think that's down to the studio, you know, because she used a different studio to George.
Right.
So when I put them on, we've got all the clicks, we've got all the hiss, the tone's not quite right, because if you play a 78 on modern equipment, it has a different equalization, so it's not quite right. That's got to be altered. So what I'd like to play now, because this says far more than any words, just listen to it. I've taken the start of one of the songs, which is Riding in the TT Races, from the film No Limit, as we mentioned, his first Ealing film. I've started that absolutely raw, as it is, you hear all the crackle and the pops and the hiss. And then I've done a crossfade into the rest of the song after I restored it. And you'd think it was a miracle.
Oh, by the way, George, have you got a motorcycle?
Have I got a motorbike?
Yes.
If there's one thing that I like, it's riding around on a motorbike. I'm a-speaking when I once begin. I once won first prize 2 and 6. I know all the dirt track dirty tricks. I'm a marvel when I'm out to win. In a 50-mile race, I am the best. I ride 5 miles and skid the rest. So come along and see me riding in the TT races. Easier than hopscotch, beating all the top-notch aces. I've been riding all my life. I started quite small. I've ridden ferry, cycles, iron scooters and all. Hear the people cheer me when they see me steering backwards. Down the hill I go at breakneck speed. See me coming down the street with the winning post on the pillion seat. Oh, come along and see me riding in the TT race.
That was Riding in the TT Races, George Formby. Just tell me, Chris, in the process of restoration, I mean, you get, what sort of state is the old 78? For example, these Formby ones, you were mentioning the lots of crackles and so on, but what do you do? What's the step-by-step procedure?
Well, the first thing is you've got to make a recording of the record. You've got to dub it. Which isn't as easy as it sounds. You've got to have a deck that'll play 78, and preferably you can vary the speed, because 78 isn't always the exact speed of it. You might be a bit faster, a bit slower.
Oh, yeah.
So you've got to get a good deck that'll do that. Then you've got to have a very good cartridge, because basically that little needle point at the end is having a piece of rock going through it at 75 revolutions per minute. 78. So you've got to have a good stylus on it. You've got to have the cartridge that will take that sort of damage to it. So it's a specialist job to get the equipment set up right. So we make the initial dub, and then you've got a choice. In this case, as I said, I made the dubs over in England, and then I brought them over to Spain on the computer, you know, digitized by then. But the other alternative is just to go straight from the record straight through the equipment that I've got, which is called Cedar. And that's in two parts, Cedar. The first part is called the B. They've got a funny name, they put click and crackle together. I think it's the B clickle, they call it. And that does its best at taking that sort of, you know, the frying egg and bacon noise off. And then the second part of that is the B hisser, because once you take the crackle, you've still got a lot of hiss on it. Now, the crackle's not so bad. That works very well, but the hiss is a very dangerous ground, because if you take too much hiss off, you also start to ruin the recording.
Oh, yeah.
So you've got to be very careful. You've got, you know, a middle ground. If you listen to some CDs even, you find that they think modern ears can't take hiss. Well, modern ears can take hiss. You soon acclimatise to it.
Yeah.
But they think, no, you can't. And they take too much off, and you're left with a horrible sound. And I would rather have a bit of hiss, which people don't notice after a minute.
Yeah, yeah.
Then, once we've gone through those two CD processors, there's so much more we can do on the computer with different filters, and we can re-equalise to make the sound brighter. And the de-clicker doesn't 100% take clicks out, so you still get little clicks that you've got to go in and take out manually and etc.
Yeah, but what an exciting thing to be doing, to be giving life again.
Yeah.
To
it's a hobby thing, really.
Yeah.
I wouldn't take a commission, because I like to do the music that I like.
Yes,
you
yes.
know, somebody came and said, oh, will you work on these Elvis Presley 78s? I said, no, thank you very much. Nothing against Elvis, but not something that I'd want to do.
Yes, yes. So there we had George and Beryl. And tell me, I think you have known friends or relations of Beryl's, is that right?
Yes, well, I've got the Formbys together as a couple, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I've known several members of the Formby family. The one that I remember best, who I used to chat to an awful lot, was George's nephew,
yeah.
Jeffrey. And he used to say, you know, this isn't true about Beryl. She wasn't an old bag at all. That's what people say.
Hmm.
She was a very warm person. She had a front on her, a professional front,
yeah.
Mainly to ward people off George, because people would, you know, swarm around him, and they'd try and get things out of him. And they had the little systems, like, you know, he'd give her the signal, and she'd come over and say, right, George, it's time to leave now. You know, basically, it was George that wanted to leave, but this is how they work the system between them.
Mm.
They reckon that they're a bit on the mean side, so sometimes, you know, the signal would come over when it was George's time to buy a round.
They work well together. Tough business, isn't it? You've got to,
yeah.
If you're running...
Behind every great man is a great woman, they say, don't they?
Yeah. So, well, tell me about the lead-up to the war work, he did in the war, because he was enormously popular, wasn't he, with the troops in France?
Oh, hugely popular, yeah. Mm. Yeah. He was one of the first entertainers to go and entertain the troops. In fact, I think he was the first in some war fronts, yeah. That recording that we heard from the radio, that was 1938, so the next thing we're going to hear wasn't all that long later.
Mm.
And it gives a good idea of how he's working on stage, but not just on stage to the, you know, the Mr. Joe public, but now to the troops. He can be a bit more bawdy, a bit more raucous. And if we listen to this is one of his, it's one of my most favourite songs, and everybody's favourite song, When I'm Cleaning Windows. But the audience actually requests this. Now, I don't for a minute think it wasn't already in the pad ready to go, but it's just lovely to hear that rapport.
Yeah.
And he works so well with the audience. Yeah. He's ad-libbing through it, and he laughs, and he pauses, and it's a totally different experience. Now, this is absolute magic, this track. This is, I think it's 1942, let me just check. Because I put this onto a CD as well. I put all of the existing wartime recordings on the CD, which I've called Formby's Finest Hours.
Gosh.
Yeah, this is from 1942, and it was an ENSA radio broadcast. But this is the magic of the man on stage. This is wonderful.
When you clean it, okay. Of course, there's not much to see now, they're all blacked out. Now I go window cleaning to earn an honest bob. For a nosy parker, it's an interesting job. Now it's a job that just suits me. A window cleaner you would be if you can see what I can see. When I'm cleaning windows, honeymooning couples do. You should see them villain coo. You'd be surprised at things they do. When I'm cleaning windows, in my profession I'll work hard, but I'll never stop. I'll climb this blinking ladder till I get right to the top. Oh, the blushing bride, she looks divine. The bridegroom, he is doing fine. I'd rather have his job than mine when I'm cleaning windows. made sweet names I call. It's a wonder I don't fall. My mind's not on my work at all. When I'm cleaning windows, I know a fella's such a swell. He has a thirst, that's plain to tell. I've seen him drink his bath as well. When I'm cleaning windows, in my profession I'll work hard, but I'll never stop. I'll climb this blinking ladder till I get right to the top. Pajamas lying side by side, ladies' nighties I have spied. I've often seen what goes inside when I'm cleaning windows. Famous talky queen, she looks a flapper on the screen. She's more like 80 than 18. When I'm cleaning windows, she pulls her hair all down behind, then pulls down her, never mind. And after that, pulls down the blind. When I'm cleaning windows, in my profession, I'll work hard, but I'll never stop. I'll climb this blinking ladder till I get right to the top. At 8 o'clock, a girl, she wakes. At 5 past 8, a bath she takes. At 10 past 8, my ladder breaks. When I'm cleaning windows.
George Formby and When I'm Cleaning Windows. And it went down well.
Didn't
obviously.
They love him?
Didn't they love him?
Didn't
yes.
they?
Yeah. And what an impact somebody like that must have had to those people, to an audience like that, a wartime audience.
He worked very hard throughout the war. He entertained millions of troops on a headcount, even millions of troops, millions of soldiers. But he was still making films, and he was still appearing in theatre shows in Britain, as well as going around the world. What I haven't had time to do today is to put a clip together from some interviews that he did after the war. Those are some amazing things, the stories that he tells about going on the front lines, and heart-rending.
Yes.
He won the OBE for his war work.
Mm.
Nowadays it would have been the knighthood, but there's no cause to be bitter, is there?
Yeah.
A friend of mine did actually write to the Prime Minister, I don't know, about 10 years ago, and said in view of the way knighthoods have been just thrown about now, I think George Formby should be given one. And they wrote back and said, we probably would agree with you, but we can't give it after the death. You know, we can only give it when someone's alive. You know, different day and age, you would have been Sir George.
Yeah.
And he was very regretful that that he got the OBE and Beryl didn't, because Beryl was at inside every step of the way. She may have even fought to some of the places she went to. George was invited and she had to fight to get passes in. You know, she did a harder job than George did, probably.
So tell me...
She was also appearing on the stage with George. You know, she was still in the routines and she was comparing shows with him as well.
Sounds an extraordinary woman. Just tell me, from your knowledge of acquaintance with people in the family, what kind of personality did George have off stage?
Apparently, he wasn't a bit like he was on stage. Not many people are they? I remember his brother Ted. He said he was quite a serious man, and you could have discussions with him about politics, even. You know, he said he didn't have a let on what his politics were, mind you.
Yeah.
But he said, no, he'd talk about the things that were in the paper that day. He wasn't the daft apis that he comes across.
Yeah.
You see, in his films, he's quite different to how he is on stage. He lights up the magic on stage and that rapport. In the films, he tends to be a bit on the daft side and a bit infantile as well.
Yeah.
You see, his films took off in across a huge board, because in England they had a north-south divide, which they don't have so much now, and it was very clever, because George was very northern, but then they would team him up with, normally the baddies were very obviously southerners, or it was obvious that the films were set in London or the home counties, so we get the north and the south. A lot of the comedy then is, I wouldn't say aimed, but it comes across in a way as being very childish, a lot of slapstick, so the kids love that. But then you get the knowing wink, you know, and the, some of the lines, and the adults love it. So it crosses everywhere. Very cleverly made.
Yes.
Very clever.
And so 47, 48, he went to New Zealand and Australia,
came out here. Yeah, he did a lot of overseas tours. But yeah, 47, 48, he went to New Zealand and then to Australia. And he actually wrote a song on the way over, which I think your listeners are going to be thrilled with, because he made broadcasts in New Zealand and Australia, and he talks specifically about New Zealand, so I had to include this. But the first one that I want to play is actually a song that George wrote, probably with Beryl's help, and it's called On the Other Side of the World, specifically for that tour.
Now I got a notion while crossing the ocean that the world was anything but small. But when I landed here, it was soon very clear that it's not so big after all. 'Cause there's your own kith and kin there to welcome you in on the other side of the world. There's the same kindly folk who crack the same kind of joke on the other side of the world. And if you go for a stroll, you'll see a flag on a pole and meet the people who kept it unfurled. And when a couple's honey-doving, it's the same old kind of loving on the other side of the world. Though we're miles from your shore, it's like living next door on the other side of the world. We've the same kind of names and play the same kind of games on the other side of the world. And when the trouble is thick, like glue together we stick, and we'll keep the old banner unfurled. So it's a very happy meeting, and I bring a special greeting from the other side of the world. Ladies and gentlemen, I've been hassed, as the lad from Lancashire would say, to come here this evening and have a few words with you. Now, they've given me a lot of names. I should say good evening to every town in New Zealand, but I can't spell them all and I can't say them, so I'm just going to say good evening all in a bunch. It's very nice to be here, and I'm going to sing a few songs to you first and do the talking afterwards.
And that was On the Other Side of the World, George Formby, the other side of the world being right here in New Zealand when he came out this way in 1947-48 on a New Zealand-Australian tour, talking to Chris Webster in Spain about the great George Formby. Chris, that one went well with his audiences too, I imagine.
Oh, yes, yes. In fact, when he finished the tour, he went on to Australia and he did four shows that's sponsored by Shell, and the very last show he rewrote the song, because it did become a theme song for him. I was in Australia, he rewrote it with different lyrics which were going back to the other side of the world. If we had time we could have played it, but I don't think we have.
Yeah.
But when he was over, a lot of it was a thank you tour, really, because the people down under, as I would call it, had done a lot of charitable things for Britain. We were having a rough time by then after the war. Things were quite meagre, and they were sending food parcels. And this is a totally different side of George we're going to hear now. This is from that same broadcast from New Zealand, which is on a CD, by the way.
Yes.
Another one. This is when he talks about that, and it's very humbling, very humbling. And this is from two sections. First we'll hear George talking about that, and then we'll cut to the end where he's saying his farewell for the audience, and we get a chance to hear Beryl, and she says her thank yous as well.
Oh.
Well, now, ladies and gentlemen, we come to the serious part of the little bit of ado. It's been a great pleasure for both Beryl and I to be over in New Zealand with you grand lot of people.
We've certainly enjoyed ourselves every minute of it. You even put the right kind of weather on for us. The day we arrived, I got wet through. And I thought I was back in Manchester. But over at home, what I would like to say to you is the appreciation of we folk at home to you kind folk out here for what you've been doing for us. All those lovely parcels you've been sending, and you are continuing to send. If I could only put into a few words what the people at home really think, then you'd be amply repaid. There was one really marvellous thing that happened the other morning. Beryl and I were coming along the street, and we saw a procession of little children. And with the children, they had these great big banners, Food for Britain. Well, of course, we at home had no idea that anything like that happened. Well, I may as well tell the truth. A lump came in my throat, and I couldn't speak for a few minutes. Because, you know, New Zealand has already done a tremendous amount in that bit of a struggle we had a couple of years ago. I do know that I think I'm right in saying that I think they gave more men for the size of the country than any other country that was in the war. And I know we met a terrible lot of them in Mardi, just outside Cairo. There'll be a few of you listening now that remember that beautiful city of Mardi. I'm going back there now. They're going to have the illuminations next week, the light in the other lamp. But I'm not going to bore you with a lot of speech-making and a lot of talking to you. I just want you to believe me when I say, on behalf of Beryl and myself, it's been grand being with you. And I'm only sorry that this trip that we can't get over the whole of New Zealand. We only have time to visit Auckland, and then we have to go off to Australia. But we shall be back again. And when we do come back, I hope that we'll be able to get round the whole of New Zealand to all the little towns. I've already been to Rotorua and seen the geysers, and he geys for us beautifully, wet us through and all. Well, folks, that's the end of the little session at the moment. But I would like to say once again, I do hope you've enjoyed the little entertainment I've tried to give for you, and that when we meet again, we'll be still as good friends as we are now. I'd just like to say once again, good night, good luck, and God bless. Now, I'd like to say, better to say good night to you.
Thank you very much, George, for giving me the chance to talk to the New Zealand people. I also would like to say how very much we all appreciate your kindness to us during the time that we're having at the moment. As you know, it has been pretty grim, but through your very, very great kindness, we're managing to weather through it very nicely. And again, thank you very much for all your lovely parcels that you have sent and that you are sending. Thank you very much.
That was George and Beryl giving their thanks, and as I say, very humbling to listen to. Lovely, lovely piece of broadcasting there. That was from 1947 in New Zealand, just before they went on to Australia, where he had a very, very big success. But Hugo, what's the big theatre in Australia? I forget the... it's gone now.
In Australia?
The Tivoli, wasn't it? The Tivoli.
Could be.
The run was extended there.
Yeah.
And, they couldn't get in. They were outside. They couldn't get into it.
Oh, really?
But I think, I mean, you know this better than I do, but isn't it quite a big event when British entertainers go to Australia anyway? And at the time, you know, because of the films, he travelled without being there. He'd already travelled. He was a great success.
Yeah.
So he was mobbed. You know, the Beatles didn't start all that sort of thing. You know, it was happening many years before.
Yeah, and that was a way to go, wasn't it? A good distance to go. It was by sea.
I don't know how he did it. I don't know whether he flew or sailed. I've never found that out. But, He went, and a lot of people were very grateful as well. But then after that, when he got back home, he had some health problems. But his heart wasn't too good. So a lot of people say, like father, like son, because the father had died young, but that was a different thing. He had tuberculosis, and that was from poor conditions when he was young, and obviously that didn't carry on. But George smoked very heavily. That could contribute to his heart condition. But as we know, he died at the age of 56, and it was only 15 years after the war. And in the 50s, he didn't do well with his heart. He was having a bad time.
Was he?
But in 1951, he did something that he'd never done before. He'd had great successes on radio, films, TV, stage. Never the West End, except for the Palladium, which was a bit different to that. So the West End out of the West End.
Yes.
And he was offered a musical show called Zip Goes a Million. And a lot of people thought, this isn't going to work. George Formby, a musical, you know, a proper high-speed musical.
Yeah.
This is at the time when musicals had changed. The sort of Noel Coward novello-type shows had gone out.
Yeah.
And the Oklahoma's and Annie Get Your Guns were coming. So the pace of musicals had changed. They thought, George Formby can't do this. Well, he did. He was a great success in it. And there's a little bit I want to play now, because his stage persona really in this was very similar to in the film. You know, he's a bit on the daft side. But there are a couple of gags in this little scene which exists from the broadcast that they made just before they went to London. They broadcast this from Manchester Opera House. And there's a few gags in this, and when I first heard this broadcast, I fell about. They're as funny today, they're as pertinent today as they were 1951.
Yeah. Interesting how some humour last, a lot of humour doesn't, but his does.
Yeah, this does. It's slightly political, and it is,
okay.
You know, when people have got no money, you know, that doesn't change.
Yeah, okay, here it is.
See, going on a bit of a binge is one thing, but $1 million in 4 months? See, only government could spend that. It's not respectable.
When we've seen this lawyer fellow, we're all going back to Newton Lee Willis.
Oh, Dad and I, maybe, but you've got a house here.
A house?
Ah.
I've not been here 5 minutes yet. I've had my name down 4 years at home and gotten out, I know that.
They're still funny, aren't they? But there was another side of George. This was always shown in his films as well. Because he always had a girlfriend, there was always that sentimental moment. And my favourite sentimental moments of George's comes from Zip Goes a Million, a beautiful song called Ordinary People. So I don't need to say much more about that, so let's just hear Ordinary People.
Ordinary People.
You know, Sally, when I was just a kid, like all the others did, I used to dream about my life's ambitions.
Did you?
In turn I planned to be, a sailor on the sea. A crook, a boy scout, or even a politician. But here I am with all the dreams I've had. An ordinary chap, but still I'm glad. Ordinary people like you and me, happy and contented as we can be. We can walk on air on our ordinary feet, strolling hand in hand along an ordinary street. Ordinary people are we until the ordinary time of day is through. And when the ordinary moon is in the ordinary sky, what extraordinary things we'll do. What extraordinary.
Ordinary People. The young lady that we heard slightly at the start was Sarah Gregory, who was his leading lady in that show. Now, he had a great success in it. He'd beaten that last thing he hadn't done, the West End. And then, as he put it himself, zip me, because he had a heart attack 6 months in. And very, very serious heart attack, and he had to come out of the show, and he was replaced by Reg Dixon, who was not the Blackpool Tower organist, but was confidentially a comedian.
Okay.
In fact, years later, Charlie Chester did it, and I believe Charlie Chester went to Australia with it.
Yes.
But George never went back into the show. He wasn't in the best of health. He did get over it, but he wasn't a well man, you know, in the 1950s. But he carried on touring. And he went to South Africa, he went to Canada, and as we had before, we had a song for Australia and New Zealand on the other side of the world. He had these little songs that I'd like to play now, maybe back to back. One of them is a well-known South African song called Sari Marais, which he sings in South African, and the other one is a song called Hello Canada. And they're both very short, they won't take up too much time, but just nice to show the effort that he put in for particular places.
Okay.
May sorry Marie is so fearful, may heart may echo on her fair to sin. Say her tenny vike from the more revere cavun, for that the all loch begin. Oh, bring my truck na the old Transvaal, da va ma sorry voon. Down in the mill is by the groom during boom, down me sorry marae. Down in the mill is by the groom during boom, down me sorry marae. The dean can't up on the only canter, whoop, da le de ding, da le de ding, da le de ding. The dean can't up on the only canter, whoop, da le de ding. Da-le-da-ding, da-le-da-ding. And we're marching to Pretoria, Icona, Sacabona. And we're marching to Pretoria, Pretoria rules the way.
Hello to everyone, it's a pleasure seeing you again. Hello Canada, it's nice to be bringing you a message from across the sea. From the land of the roses and the heather blue, to the land of the maple leaf so staunch and true. It's hello Canada, the old country sends her kind regards to you.
Two songs by George Formby sung for his trip to South Africa and his trip to Canada. So he certainly honoured the places he went to, didn't he, with his music?
Oh yes, yeah. He didn't make it in America. He did Canada because Canada was British, of course. Didn't make it in America, but he could have done. He was offered Carnegie Hall, and they said, "Name your price." There's a blank check. He says, "No, I think he was a bit scared. He needn't have been, but I think he thought, no, I don't think I'm going to be right there." Mm. He just had this gut feeling, so he said, "No, I don't want to do it. I can't go at the moment anyway because my dog's not well." So he got out of it himself. I'm sure he would have worked. There's an entertainer who's passed on now, but Alan Randall was very well known in the 60s and 70s as a Formby impersonator. Mm. And he was doing the big casino places, you know, Sahara Sands and all that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
He was going down the storm with his little ukulele doing George Formby songs, so if he could do it, pretty certain George could have done.
Yeah, should have worked.
He didn't have the nerve for that. Isn't that amazing, really?
Mm. Yeah, that
think
is.
What he'd done in the war. And he really had been close to the battlefront. You'd heard the sniper's firing, you know, is that close?
Yes,
it's
revealing, isn't it, the frailties of people like that. You know, you think that he'd be hardened to any audience. And so what about television?
Well, it was around this time, we're talking now about mid to late 50s, and television has taken off in a big way for variety shows. Commercial TV started, I think, in 55. So the BBC had to up their ante a little bit to compete with them, because commercial TV was far more popular than the stuffy old BBC.
Mm.
So George Formby was on both channels, and he was doing very, very well. And this raised his career, and he was back into summer shows. Instead of doing the odd one-off show or little tours, he was back into summer shows. And the big one for him was in 1959, when he did the Windmill Theatre at Yarmouth. Again, as in The Zip Goes a Million, he had to come out the show for a short while, but I think that was a motoring accident.
Mm.
And Tommy Trinder came in just for a few weeks, and then George came back. And it had the biggest box office success that theatre had ever had.
That's how
this is another silly thing, that he was offered a different theatre, a much, much bigger theatre. And again, he didn't have that confidence. He didn't think he was a star, but he was. He said, no, I'll take the little theatre. I'd rather fill the little theatre than have a big theatre half empty.
Fancy that.
In the end, they had to, you know, extend the run there.
And he
would have gone back to Yarmouth the next year,
yeah.
But he was offered Blackpool, because Blackpool was closer to home,
right.
And more prestige in those days to Blackpool.
Was
1960.
Was Beryl still...
Sorry, Hugo?
Was Beryl still influential in what he was doing at that stage?
Oh, yes, Beryl was still around. Mm-hmm. Yes, she wasn't very well by this time. Mm-hmm. She was quite poorly. And I don't even think she was at the theatre all that often.
Yeah.
But, yeah, she was still around. But by 1960, he did a show at the Queen's Theatre, Blackpool. That was so successful that they extended the run, and they booked him to appear the next year. But sadly, he died before that could happen, and so did Beryl. Beryl died on Christmas Eve, very late Christmas Eve, 1960.
Yeah.
So late, that's what some of the books now say. She died on Christmas Day, but it wasn't. It was Christmas Eve, which was a great blow to him. But... before we get to the sad bit, let's have something happy. This is a soundtrack from one of his TV appearances, and more or less, as live, he's working in the studio with an audience, and he's sparkling again, and this is one of his great hits, this is Auntie Maggie's Remedy.
There's all sorts of remedies that you can buy, no matter what ailment you've got. But I've got a special one you ought to try. You'll find it's the best of the lot. It's me, Auntie Maggie's homemade remedy. It's guaranteed never to fail. Now that's the stuff that will do the trick. It's sold in every chemist for one and a kick. Now if you get lumbago, rheumatics or gout, or a pain in your rubber tilly, don't kick up a shindy, you'll never get windy with Auntie Maggie's remedy. Now if you set your alarm clock for 8 in the morning, you're bound to wake up, I'll agree. But I'll bet you by heaven, you'll jump out at 7 with Auntie Maggie's remedy. Auntie Maggie's homemade remedy is guaranteed never to fail. Now that's the stuff that will do the trick. It's sold at every chemist for one and a kid. In the young lady's bedroom I went by mistake. My intentions were honest, you see. But she shouted with laughter, I know what you're after, my Auntie Maggie's remedy. Auntie Maggie's homemade remedy, it's guaranteed never to fail. Now that's the stuff that will do the trick. It's sold in every chemist for one and a kick. Now I know a girl who is putting on weight in a spot where it just shouldn't be. So I said to Nellie, now you rub your kneecap with Auntie Maggie's remedy.
Auntie Maggie's Remedy from George Formby. So, Chris Webster in Spain, with your remarkable collection of George Formby music and that you've been restoring, it's a fascinating life story, isn't it, of George Formby? There he was performing at a great pace after very serious heart trouble, and still just as popular.
Oh yes, yes. I did know somebody that spoke to him and. He said, why don't you do more work, George? He said, I know people don't want to see me anymore. I haven't done pictures for years. I haven't made records for years. I'm not a star. he said, George, you are a star. And, of course, then the comeback started. I don't know whether he really meant it or not, you know, because surely he must have known he's a star. We'll never know. We'll never know. Mm. I think there always was something. We'll hear something in a moment that's quite beautiful, and the humility is incredible. But we'll come to that in a moment, though.
Mm.
Just to really wind up the story, around this time, this was about 1959-60, he was asked by Pi Records to go into the studio to make a new recording. And this really happened by accident, because this is a song that they offered Lonnie Donegan, who was a Pi artist at the time.
Hmm.
And he said, oh no, this is more the sort of thing George Formby would do. Why do you want me to do it? He said, well, you can do it like George Formby. He said, if you want someone to do it like George Formby, why don't you get George Formby? So they got George Formby. And the A side was Happy Go Lucky Me, and the B side, which was recorded second, so this is the last recording, was called Banjo Boy. And it amuses me, really, all the years that you go around saying, it's not a banjo, it's a ukulele, and the last record was Banjo Boy. And you'll hear that the voice has dropped, the years have taken their toll. But it's a very sweet record, it's nice. This is Banjo Boy from Pi, 1960.
Play a song, little banjo boy. Banjo boy, banjo boy. Sing along, little banjo boy. Sing your carefree melody. Every plink, plink sends a happy feeling through my heart. Who could think of a worry when your blink, blink starts bright and clear? Let me hear your sweet song of joy. Play for me, my banjo boy. Feeling through my heart. Who could think of the worry when your blink blink start? Play a song, little banjo boy. Banjo boy, banjo boy. Sing along, little banjo boy. Play your carefree melody.
Every blink, blink sends a happy feeling through my heart. Who can think of a worry when your blink pops out?
Bright and clear, let me hear your sweet song of joy. Play for me, my banjo boy.
Banjo Boy from Pi Records in 1960. That was the last record that he made in a studio. Then he had a very successful season in Blackpool, which I just referred to. Then a remarkable thing happened. Given the chain of events that would happen in the next few months, it was amazing. But he was invited by the BBC to do a 35-minute one-man show, basically telling his life story interspersed with a few songs. And I think this is one of the most wonderful pieces of television history that there ever was. People saw a totally different George Formby to this, a different side to him. You have to bear in mind that by this time, Beryl was very, very ill. This is December 1960. She died Christmas Eve 1960. This is the first few weeks of December. So she was in bed dying when he made it. He plays recordings of his dad, and this is in the Shepherd's Bush Empire, which was used as a television studio. So he's got the audience there, and he's sitting in an armchair listening to a record of his dad being played over the speaker with an audience, and he cries. And this is going out on national TV. Not live, but, you know, it did go out.
Mm.
This had never been known. Then he confesses things. Some people call it the confession show. He says, I never learned to read and write properly. He says, I don't understand music, you know. He says some wonderful things about Beryl. You know, it wouldn't have happened without her. And he gets quite emotional when he's saying that.
Hmm.
But one of the most magical things for me is this little talk we're going to hear now. It's only a few seconds. It's just how he was with his audiences. Again, this is the sort of thing, when I was saying before, he didn't realise that he was still a star. He was still a star. And this is, the humility is so moving here. I can very rarely listen to this without shedding a tear. So we'll have a listen to this. I always call this star talk.
People say to me, how did you become a star? It's a daft question, isn't it? I mean, what do? We don't do anything. We don't become stars. You people make us stars. We wouldn't be any good without you. And any of our present stars today, if they ever believe anything different, they're crazy. I shall always be grateful to the public for what they've done for me.
Well, I think that's absolutely amazing, Hugo.
Yeah.
A man talking from the heart, that's incredible.
Yes.
On national television, and in front, live, of several hundred people. Wonderful, wonderful bit of broadcasting there.
It says something about his character, doesn't it?
Pardon?
It says something about his character, doesn't it?
It says an awful lot about the man. If we didn't have that, I don't think we would really know half of as much. We just know the persona. That was the real man.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Anyway, that was early December 1960. Then he went into pantomime in Bristol, and he was driving back from Panto that Beryl died on Christmas Eve, which was terrible blow for him, terrible. And he came out of the Panto only about a week later. He did go straight back into it. No, he didn't lose any time. He straight back in. People were amazed because they were a big showbiz couple, you know.
Yeah.
But he went back into the Panto, but only for a few days, and they all took over, and he wasn't the well man. But then an amazing thing happened is that only weeks later, he suddenly announced his engagement to an old family friend that he'd known from when she was a little girl, who was quite a few years as junior, called Pat Howson. And this sort of shocked the world, I think, in a nice way, in some ways, but it was so soon after Beryl. But he said he was looking at I don't think it was a love life type thing. He just wanted someone to look after him. He said that himself. I mean, there was an affection there, but I don't think it's that sort of relationship. And it's quite clear when you look at them together on bits of film that she adored him. I think it was more of a niece and uncle relationship, really, the companionship.
Yeah.
But sadly, incredibly, just a few weeks after they announced their engagement, 6th of March, 1961, those dates etched forever, you know. George passed away, had a heart attack, and he was in hospital, and he passed away. And that's really the end of part one of the Formby story. But, of course, part two is that's over 50 years ago, and this legacy is incredible. Only months after George died, a society was formed, which meets at Blackpool four times every year, even to this day, the George Formby Society. Now, it's had its ups and downs, but at the moment, the membership is higher than it's ever been. It's incredible. And we've got more young people than there's ever been. And I mainly put it down, I think, to the internet, because there's so much you can go and see on YouTube now. The films aren't shown on television very often. They certainly don't play the record very often on the radio, not on the stations, the BBC stations. So there's not a lot of exposure, but it's there. Of course, there's a revival in the ukulele as well, the instrument. So that certainly helps, because I suppose some people who get into the uke then get into George Formby afterwards.
Well,
the other way around.
The ukulele has had a great comeback, hasn't it, too?
Oh, yes. I play myself.
Do you? was that
that
a ukulele we had?
Yeah. Well, as well as doing sound restoration work, I'm also an entertainer.
I see.
I do a double act with a friend of mine. I play the piano, and he sings all nostalgia stuff, and then I do my George Formby act as well.
You do that, too?
A lot of comedy.
Oh, I fancy that. Well, I was...
It's aimed at the senior age of the market. But,
yeah.
We do it in Spain, in theatres. I mean, we're still the theatres. We've got quite a following, actually.
Oh, yeah. We'll have to have you performing
on... enjoyable to do.
We'll have to have you performing on Radio Akatuna, Radio Woodville, one day. But,
I don't but know about that.
It's interesting with the people enjoying him, and you're saying young people, that phenomenon of young people being attracted to something that for years we've thought of as really being back then and no longer relevant.
Yeah, You see, the instrument is coming around again, because you can play pop songs on the instrument, you know.
Mm.
But this is what surprises me, that people then find George Formby songs.
Yeah.
I think a pop ear wouldn't like, you know, the ear for 20s songs, 30s songs, 40s songs.
Yeah.
But they do, because they're still musical. And they've got melodies, and this is what a lot of songs don't have now, melodies. Mm. And this has been my... If I ever come back in a second life as a lady, I'm going to be called Melody, I think. I've always said for years that's what songs are about, melody, not rhythm so much.
So how would you characterise George Formby's legacy then, you know, in musical terms, in show business terms?
Well, there's still a lot of tribute acts in the theatres. He's kept going alive, you know, in the theatres themselves. You can buy all but one of his 20 films on DVD now. You can buy every one of his recordings over, I think, 10 CDs. Every single one of them, even outtakes that exist. And then there's people like me that come along that have done private recordings. I've done 7 CDs. I've done recordings from radio broadcasts, from live shows, soundtracks from films. I've got one set which is just the soundtracks from TV shows, which in many cases the shows don't exist anymore. Fans in the 1950s put their microphone on the tape recorder next to the TV, so they've survived. And these are some of the best things. You know, we've got to thank people for pirating, really, you know.
Yeah.
And another set I've got is two whole discs just of interviews between, I think, mid-40s to early-50s. A lot of it talking about the work that he did in the war.
Yeah.
And they're incredible to listen to, wonderful to listen to.
So he's here to stay, by the sound of it.
I think more than ever, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the society has had its peaks and its troughs, and there's always been a down bit where you think, well, all right, we might be winding down now, it's been 20 years, and then after 25 years, suddenly something's happened, and it's back again.
Mm.
But it's riding high at the moment, and I think it's going to for a long, long time to come.
So what song will you finish off with, Chris?
There's only one big one that we haven't played, and we've got to have it. It's Lean on a Lamppost. I'll take this to a desert island with me.
Of course.
And this is rather special, this, because it's not a studio recording. It's from that last TV show, and it's the song that closed the show.
Chris Webster, audio restoration specialist in Spain, in Alicante, in Spain, talking direct to Radio Ecatahuna and Radio Woodville. Thank you very much for talking to us and for all the work you've put into getting the music together. Fascinating story of George Formby. And I hope we can have you back sometime, Chris, to perhaps sing a song or two. You never know.
maybe. Well, thank you very much, Hugo. It's a pleasure to just go on about my favourite thing. So freely, as you've allowed me to do. Thank you very much.
Well, let's listen to that favourite song. George Formby, Leaning on a Lamppost.
I'm leaning on a lamppost at the corner of the street in case a certain, come on, lady comes by. Oh, me, oh, my, I hope the little lady comes by. I don't know if she'll get away. She doesn't always get away, but anyhow I know that she'll try. Oh, me, oh, my, I hope the little lady comes by. There's no other girl I could wait for, but this one I'd break any day for. I won't have to ask what she's late for. She wouldn't leave me flat, she's not a girl like that. She's absolutely beautiful and marvelous and wonderful, and anyone can understand why. I'm leaning on a lamppost at the corner of the street in case a certain little lady passes by. Come on now, whistle. I'm leaning on a lamppost at the corner of the street in case a certain little lady. That's right, swing it. Oh, me. Oh, my. I hope the little lady comes by. I don't know if she'll get away. She doesn't always get away, but anyhow, I know that she'll try. Oh, me. Oh, my. I hope the little lady comes by. There's no other girl I can wait for. This one I'm praying any day. She's grateful. She wouldn't be a girl like leaning on a lamppost at the corner of the street.